Ars Electronica 2008. A new cultural economy.
Welcome to day two and the third session of the symposium. Yesterday, I don't know how many of you were here yesterday, but yesterday we had a very interesting discussion about production, commons-based peer production, and sort of what happens after the firm. And we also had in the afternoon a discussion about piracy and media and content. And this morning we have the small topic about talking about the truth and sort of the future of authority, or at least that's what the session is supposed to be about. We'll see what actually turns out to be about. And I'll just introduce the moderator and the chair of this next session, Jamie Boyle, who is one of my mentors. He's the chairman of the board of Creative Commons, and so I sort of work for Jamie. But he's also well known for being the guy who is doing free culture stuff since before Lawrence Lessig. So that's so he's kind of an old timer here. He's written lots of books, and including a comic book that you can download about the commons. And so without further ado, I'll have Jamie come up. He said he wanted his introduction to be short, and I think Jamie will introduce the rest of the panelists in the session. Thank you.
Thank you, Joey, and thank you for inviting me here. Joey's introductions betray his Japanese heritage because there are always lots of hidden messages in them. It's kind of like a haiku. So the ones that you may have seen in there were that I'm his mentor and that I'm an old-timer, both of which indicate that I'm older than he is, and that's true. So I already feel old. I'm fascinated to find out that he works for me, though. This is something that has never been clear in our prior interactions. Joey is a person who I admire for many reasons, but one of them is that he has almost as many miles spent in self-discovery as he has frequent flyer miles. And these are all chronicled on Joey's blog. And with that, I think, spirit in mind, Joey gave me the enviable task of moderating this panel, which has the wonderful title, Science, Religion, Art, Literature, and the Pursuit of Truth. There should be a colon then, and then after that we should say, and some other things too. So I like the narrowness of the topic. Thank you, Joey. So what we're going to be talking about today, I think, and I think this is true from each of our panelists, are the ways in which networks and cultural networks change the ways that we think about meaning and truth and religion and science and taste. So if yesterday's presentations were about the organization of the cultural economy, maybe today's session is about the organization of the cultural epistemology, our form of knowledge. We have four wonderful panelists, and I'm going to introduce them now so that I don't have to pop up during the during their speeches. The first is ACMA, a.k.a. Adam, who's, I'm delighted to say, a visiting professor at Duke, a visiting professor of New Testament. And he's the author of What is Postmodern Biblical Criticism? And I won't attempt to summarize what he's going to talk about because you will learn very soon. Then we have David Weinberger. David Weinberger is a fellow at Harvard's Berkman Center. He's the co-author of the Clue Train Manifesto and also of Everything is Miscellaneous, and of Small Pieces Loosely Joined. Three excellent titles, I think you'd have to agree. Then we have Jonah Brooker Cohen. Jonah is a researcher, writer, and artist, and an adjunct assistant professor of communications at NYU's Interactive Telecommunications Program. And then finally, Ronaldo Lemos. Ronaldo is another of my colleagues from Creative Commons and iCommons. He's the director of the Center for Technology and Society at the, I won't attempt to pronounce the Portuguese, School of Law in Rio de Janeiro. He's also the director of Creative Commons Brazil and the chairman of the board of iCommons. So those are our panelists, and I'm going to ask ACMA to start us off. ACMA, thank you.
Good morning. Once upon a time, this festival that celebrates the convergence of technology and the arts would have taken place under the sponsorship of Bishop Schmidt of the Diocese of Linz, or of His Eminence Christoph Cardinal Schönborn, Archbishop of Vienna, Christoph Cardinal Schönborn, Archbishop of Vienna. Theology, as the Queen of the Sciences, would preside with grace and generous affirmation at our symposium, celebrating the contributions of such great religious scientists as Roger Bacon, Nicholas of Cusa, Copernicus, Kepler, Boyle, Newton, Linnaeus, Leibniz, Mendel, and countless others. But although many of the West's great technological thinkers have been active Christians, and although tech activists have begun some admirable projects, clicker misfunction. Theological discourse intrudes awkwardly into tech discourse, and at conferences such as these, priests are out of place most of the time. And although tech activists have begun, nowadays technologists and theologians frequently seem to be talking past one another rather than to one another. Now, one can explain the disjunction in a variety of ways. Tech geeks frequently perceive Christians as theocratic despots who want nothing more than to assimilate everyone to their dogmatism, and the conduct of some Christians warrants such suspicions. On the other hand, some theological leaders approach technology with profound doubts. Church authorities typically evince replacement panic, the heightened dread that digital existence and communication will undermine and eventually supersede physical interactions. Such caricatured antipathy trades in mutual ignorance, and it handicaps the fullest efforts of each party. Technological innovators stand to gain a great deal by engaging with ecclesiastical communities, and ecclesiastical communities stand to benefit from advancing closer to the cutting edge of digital technologies. The benefits for the church are obvious. A large part of our ministry involves communication and attention, and digital technology affords an unparalleled vehicle for these. Moreover, to the extent that people devote more and more of their energies to digital technology, it behooves the church not to abandon the digital dimension, but to indigenate itself online. The benefits to technological innovators are less obvious, but every bit as weighty. The churches constitute a vast, well-established social network of ordinary civilians with a strong presence around the world and with considerable economic impact. Whatever the appeal of such junk food, ecclesiastical junk food as the Da Vinci Code and Left Behind, it manifestly rests on something other than literary quality or theological insight. The impact of these print media publications demonstrates a public's ravenous appetite for theological information. Technologists who collaborate with church groups have a great opportunity to observe their ideas in action, and everybody benefits when patient attention supplants uninformed dismissal. If techs and theos were in fuller conversation, someone might already have pointed out that many of the concerns that have energized Creative Commons, EFF, Ars Electronica, had already affected the 19th century. At the beginning of the 1800s, printing presses still operated by hand. Only in 1810 was the steam-powered printing press patented, and only in the 1820s were steam presses becoming generally available. At the crest of this very disruptive technological innovation, a provincial clergyman came to Paris and used the new media of 19th century Europe to disrupt both the publishing industry and the Catholic Church. Jacques-Paul Migne, an undistinguished ecclesiastical troublemaker from Orléans, arrived in Paris in the 1830s and set about establishing a religious newspaper, ostensibly neutral in politics and a neutral point of view, but inevitably colored by Migne's own control of the newspaper's operations. Migne's L'Univers Religieux succeeded rapidly, partly because his ultramontane Catholicism fit well the temper of Paris during the July monarchy. Migne stayed in the newspaper business less than a year, only long enough to build circulation to a respectable figure and sell L'Univers off at a tidy profit. But during that year, he discovered what would be the key of his operation, the most efficient means of editing a paper. He copied articles wholesale from the competition. One of his competitors complained, "L'Univers copies everything. It is short, two or three columns to fill a particular volume. Quick, a pair of scissors, and in 2 minutes it will have solved its little problem." When Migne used his bankroll to return to the newspaper business, founding, among other newspapers, La Voix de la Vérité, which, after having been sold and changing its name, became Le Monde, he pioneered a system of gathering reports of interest from other newspapers and reprinting them unaltered, save for an introductory phrase naming the source. One reads in the Gazette des Tribunaux. In fact, Migne made an explicit point that he stole this material from other journals. It demonstrated, so he claimed, the purity of his neutral point of view publishing practices. Migne made a fortune in part by inventing the process of scraping news feeds and republishing them in much the same way that spammy websites do today. Migne's newspaper business flourished, and from the proceeds, he began assembling the dominant force in publishing in mid-century Europe. At a time when steam presses were still unusual in France, Migne maintained five presses running continuously in his Atelier Catholique. And to put those five presses in context, there were roughly 50 other steam presses in all of the département de la Seine, which was itself the most industrialized printing center in France. There were only 117 steam presses in all of France in 1861. At the height of his operation, Migne employed about three times as many workers as the famous Didot publishing house. So publishing, and in a certain sense editing, several newspapers at once, did not satisfy Jacques Migne. He had greater things in mind. With the power of the steam press at his disposal, and with the brilliant insight that he could publish other authors' works without paying them, he launched his magnum opus, the Latin and Greek Petrologies, that are now known in the theological field simply by his name. Migne published what he called a universal theological library comprising 25 volumes of biblical commentary, a 25-volume encyclopedia of dogmatic theology, an 18-volume anthology of Christian apologetics, 99 volumes of sermons, a three-series Christian encyclopedia totaling 169 volumes, a history of the church in 27 volumes, and a 13-volume anthology in praise of the Blessed Virgin Mary, plus 150 miscellaneous works. That's apart from the 218 volumes of the Patrologia Latina and the 166 volumes of the Patrologia Graeca. The premise of Migne's Patrologias is unimpeachable. By reprinting the works of theologians who had been dead for centuries, most of them for more than a millennium, he served the church's need for educational nourishment while at the same time encountering no inconvenient accusations of plagiarism. The only catch to that plan was that sometimes the best editions of the ancient theologians had been published within the minimal interval protected by copyright. While most of Meany's editions relied on legitimate public domain sources, he did not allow the formality of copyright to stand in his way. Meany would offer editors paltry licensing fees, threatening to print an older, inferior alternative if the editor of the superior version did not agree to terms. And sometimes, characteristically, he went ahead and published the copyrighted edition anyway. If Meany's steam-powered newspapers were the partisan print version of Google News web scraping, his Patrologia was in certain respects a theological literature Pirate Bay. Nor was Meany's approach unique. In Edinburgh, the firm of T&T Clark began commissioning fresh editions and translations of the same works that Meany was pirating in France. Unfortunately, the cost of paying editors and translators surpassed the interest that T&T Clark could generate in their series. They sold roughly 11 copies per year of each of the books they published. They discontinued the series to cut their losses. But over in the USA, where copyright law at that point did not protect foreign works, the Right Reverend Arthur Cox gathered up T&T Clark's volumes and reprinted them in a series with his own introductions. T&T Clark, having invested so much in the editions, protested vigorously on both legal and spiritual grounds. The collected volumes had done so well in the U.S. that Cox's publishers offered Clark a licensing fee of $125 per volume, little enough, but a great deal better, as it turns out, than Clark had been doing on the books before they were pirated. Cox and his publishers then extended the series, adding further pirated or extorted translations. Since then, Cox's Anti-Nicene and Post-Nicene Fathers have been reprinted continuously for more than 100 years, and to this day frequently are found in English-speaking pastors' libraries, although they are usually unread. One more example, Charles Sheldon's famous book, In His Steps, the book that popularized among Protestants the question, what would Jesus do, was published with a defective copyright notice. The publisher submitted it to the Copyright Office with one copy, not two, as was required. As a result, publishers in the US and abroad prepared their own editions of the public domain bestseller, and Sheldon reputedly received only $275 in royalties for the 25 million copies of the book in print. So this morning I'm asking you to imagine the tremendous appetite for theological media, as witness the Da Vinci Code and Left Behind, and the historic examples of Meany, the Anti-Nicene and series In His Steps, and situate all of this in the context of the transition into digital media that Ars Electronica celebrates. As the matter of copyright in an age of digital reproduction becomes increasingly vexed and the pressure for open access publication increases, theological publishing might serve as a very useful fishbowl for tech innovators. The first steps have been taken, and they come a good deal short of a revolution. The Anti-Nicene and Post-Nicene Fathers series that Bishop Cox pirated more than 100 years ago has been digitized and marked up in a good XML format, but A, they have not established any avenues for supporting print versions of their library that coordinate with the digital versions, and B, they assert copyright control over their marked up versions. Various other sites online have developed libraries of out of copyright and soft pirated versions of texts. Everyone knows there's a brisk traffic in badly scanned PDFs of textbooks and other prominent literature. Yet no one, no organization has broken through to offer open access digital works in a comfortably readable, non-proprietary format, in a form that permits congruent comparison to printed books. So look, we know that the conditions for publishing will undergo some sort of convulsive change in the next few years. That change won't displace books. We needn't have print media replacement panic. But it will involve a much more robust, more sophisticated, and we may hope a vastly more open exchange of digitally distributed literature. What we need is to rely on the particular benefits of digital media, shareable, searchable, downloadable, disposable texts, in a way that is congruent with the special benefits of print media, durable, artifactual, ownable texts. And to develop, with the support of some institution, some generous benefactor, an open standard format. PDF will do if we absolutely must, but an open format would be much preferable to a proprietary format. Texts in an area in which there's demonstrably high interest. Tor science fiction books are demonstrating the viability of this as part of their publishing business model, with direct correlation to print copies. Again, Tor provides an excellent case in point, because the legacy format of print media will survive and will generate cash flow. If you know of anyone who would be interested in supporting such a thing, please, I'm eager to hear about it, because when access to media is open and the format is open and the community is drawn together on the basis of a shared interest, users will have the tools and the incentive to participate in the production of knowledge, in the discourses of truth. And that's a consummation I think that we all can aim towards realizing, if only we could find this century's Jacques-Paul Migne, this medium's Jacques-Paul Migne. And if you're looking for a volunteer, you know where to find me. Thank you very much.
Okay, good. Thank you very much, Akma. I thought I'd start off by asking you a quick question. Taking seriously the opposition you set up at the beginning between theological discussion and technological discussion, because as you pointed out, they weren't always separate. And in fact, many of the geeks of the 16th, 17th, and 18th centuries were deeply involved in theological debates, pro, con, and in the middle. So I want to ask seriously the question, but I want to turn it around. You pointed out that technologists should see in the world of faith and faith-based text and knowledge an opportunity for the kind of commons that they get excited about elsewhere. I want to turn the question around and ask you why the community of the faithful have not seen the issues of intellectual property to be something that gets in the way of the practice of their faith in an organized way. And I'll just give one example. Many of you may not know, but because of the absurdly long copyright terms, the length of time that copyright lasts, many pieces of music which you believe are in the public domain, Ravel's Bolero, for example, are actually still under copyright and you still have to pay fees. And that is actually true for much of the sacred music played in churches. I routinely get questions from people who want to play sacred music for their orchestras or in their churches and find they simply can't afford the licensing fees. And the most pathetic and tragic example I got was from a lady who was the organist at my local church, at a local church near me, not one that I attend. And she said, I have a parishioner who is dying of cancer. I want to record CDs of our sermons and send them to her. Frankly, although I won't tell the minister this, she doesn't listen to the sermons, she only listens to the music, because his sermons aren't very good, but don't tell him. It was not ACMA's sermons, I want to be clear. But she said, but I know I'm not allowed to do this because I'm breaking the law. And I know I've tried to contact these people to say how much to make one copy for this person who's dying of cancer of the songs that are sung in a church. And they send back a letter and say $5,000 per hymn. And so she said, I don't know what to do. And I said, please just go right ahead. And when they sue you, just come to me. I'll be so happy. And believe me, there was nothing I want better than to be standing beside a, you know, a Baptist organist saying, George Bush, this is what's wrong with intellectual property today, because this is a community you actually care about, unlike anyone else I ever talked to. So I say that seriously. That was a tragic case, but it's a real situation in which this is something which actually impacts the exercise of faith. Why is there not more organization within the world of the faithful looking at technological and legal restraints rather than the other way around?
It's an interesting question, and it has a variety of dimensions you won't be surprised to hear. One of them, on the historic side, at least for the practice of English common law and the Church of England, involves the Crown's prerogative to control publishing and owning the rights to the Book of Common Prayer in perpetuity, likewise the King James Bible. Of course, take that across the ocean, and the Bible publishing industry was actually one of the big startups in the 19th century U.S., which we could get away with because the king couldn't enforce copyright on this side. The American Episcopal Church's Book of Common Prayer has copying restrictions that are not legal copyright, but require that you reproduce the wording precisely, and you can reprint it as you will. But I think that replacement panic, the fear that somehow the physical instantiations of things we do digitally will just disappear in all our precious goods and our personal physical interactions will evaporate is one element. And assimilation to the culture of property where people will give up their intellectual property rights. Yesterday afternoon, Garrett and Tomas and the afternoon panel covered this so well that if there's one chance in a zillion that your song might appear in a movie and you'll get paid millions of dollars and go live in a condo on the beach, then you're not going to allow the Baptist organist to use it once for free, because that might limit your rights in subsequent uses. One of the reasons that I'm calling on the benefactors of the world to unite and to get involved in this particular community is that with momentum in a particular area, we may be able to dislodge some of the assumptions and habits that are impeding progress on wider fronts. That's my hope anyway.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Sure.